Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Keith Brabender, and this show is called Old and New, and it's a holiday. So I just thought I would go ahead and do one because some people are working and some aren't. And it was an opportunity. I didn't have any time to do it yesterday. Today I'm going to talk about art again and Charlie Hebdo. And I'm going to try to pronounce that name correctly each time today. And what happened in France and the assassinations and murders of the people who were there in the country of France over this magazine that published what were considered to be derogatory articles or pictures of Muhammad. What I would like to talk about today is something quite different, but in line with what I talked about on Saturday, and that is how art is seen in politics and how the culture attempts to use art for its own purposes and what it means in contemporary society. I'd like to remind you that I have a novel on Amazon called A Deserted Place and a book of poetry called The Summit of Things. You can get them under my name, Keith Brabender, or the names of the books, A Deserted Place or The Summit of Things. And my name is Keith Brabender, and this show is Old and New. Before I start the show, though, I'd like to say this is a holiday, and it's Martin Luther King Day. And one of the things I would like to mention to you is one of the greatest ironies in American history, in my opinion, is if you look at a calendar, and I have a, you know, you go to the drugstores and different places, and they still publish paper calendars. Many, many people don't use them now because they use electronic calendars instead on their phones or their computers, but there are still out there, there are paper calendars. And I have a paper calendar I was looking at the other day from this year, and it has on the Martin Luther King Day, it is a celebration of his birthday. And the other person's birthday on the calendar that is celebrating is Robert E. Lee. And if there's ever an example of the schizophrenia of American history, it is to have Robert E. Lee Day and Martin Luther King Day on the same day. And I knew a guy I worked with professionally about 15, 20 years ago who told me he went to school in Virginia and they never celebrated Martin Luther King Day. They, in the school he was in, they celebrated Robert E. Lee Day. Robert E. Lee is a really hard guy to celebrate, and it's not simply because he lost for the losing side in the Civil War. It's because there's been a lot written about this in history books and philosophy books about how you determine the greatness of a historical figure. And one of the things that has to be looked at in the greatness of a historical figure is what legacy they leave behind. What did they do to alter a society that was for the good and was lasting? And I don't really know what exactly you would say, put that into that category with Robert E. Lee in relation to Martin Luther King Jr., but apparently people do. And as I said, I think this is still based on a mythology, and it's the mythology of the South that it created for itself after the Civil War that in many ways has never died. It's still very much held in just for some people as a truth that is not a fiction that was created by the losers of the American Civil War. And if you think about it in real terms, and you're really not trying to be that sympathetic to the Southerners, who, when the South lost the war, who really lost the war? Because if you look at the slaves and you look at the people who lived in the country, I mean, an awful lot of them were winners in the war when it was over, as opposed to saying they actually lost it. The losers of the war, obviously, were many of the people of the South and the thousands and thousands of soldiers that were killed or wounded. But as I heard a historian say one time about the Deep South, this was one of the most extraordinary cultures ever created because it institutionalized slavery and the rights of didn't and refused to institutionalize the rights of women, that created what she argued was probably the most patriarchal, racist culture in perhaps Western history, and it was in the 19th century, in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. And she, the woman I saw speak about it, said to this day she has no understanding as to why anybody has any sympathy for what went on down there. But she said, when she, as a professor of history, when she writes articles and really criticizes the South, she said she gets very hostile reactions when she does. Anyway, I'm going to go on today with Charlie Hebdo. And what I'm going to talk about today is the relationship between aesthetics and religion. Now, this is a very important subject, and I have talked about it before. But what this means is, in the minds of many, is if you go through various lectures and books that have been written, there's been a lot said about the fact that what the Western society has done is that in many ways it has abandoned religion and substituted aesthetics in its place. I think I told you it was Terry Singleton that brought this up in a couple lectures, and it's very interesting how he describes it. And there's a lot of other people who have talked about it as well. This is pretty much what they say in a nutshell. If you read literature on religion, you will find people discussing ecstatic states. You'll find people talking about being blissful. This is a very common term in the Western version of Hinduism. You'll find people trying to find certain areas of peace and of mind and consciousness and these kinds of aspects. And what the discussion has said is, since around the turn of the century or before, there have been a lot of people in Western culture who have used the same terms that were used for religion that were used for aesthetics, for art, poetry, and the arts in general. I'm using aesthetics here to mean style and arts in general. Now, this is interesting because if you go back to the Middle Ages and move forward through the Renaissance in Western civilization, the church itself was very directly connected to the high arts. You know, the great masterpieces and the greatest paintings made and statues made in the Western world were done through the church, the Roman Catholic Church. And you have, you know, the Sistine Chapel, and you have Michelangelo, and you have all these different, and many of the, if you go to a museum, enormous amounts of the art are about the, you know, religious depictions of Christ and particularly Mary. Now, this is also true in music. You know, some of the most extraordinary music of the Renaissance period was holy music. It was sacred music. And the choirs and the way it was sung, and even today, when we now used mixed choirs of men and women when they previously did not, and they used boys, even if they're sung by the women now, you know, because it wasn't exactly written for them, but when they do it, it's extraordinarily incredible music, and it's really extraordinary to hear what the inspiration was for people to have written something of that sort. When you substitute aesthetics for religion and you lose the inspiration, many would say that this has become one of the fundamental problems of Western society. Because what is the inspiration for making art in the modern world? And what kind of art do you end up with when your inspiration is not a religious, high-end, mystical kind of understanding of the beauty of the world? I mean, what do you end up with? That's one question. But there's another question that's even much more important, and that is that a society judges itself solely on its aesthetics. Now, I'm going to give you two very practical examples of this, particularly since we're talking about France, so it doesn't seem abstract. If you go around America, and that's my first example, you will notice that one of the first things a city does that in its attempt to try to show people that it is part of a great urban society and that it's really kind of hip and cool, is it it opens an art and music section of the city. What this happens is you have an area of the town, and then it can expand, that has restaurants, art store, art galleries, bookstores. In the modern world, if you are an intelligent, educated, hip person, you're not distinguished by whether or not you go to a Methodist church or a Catholic church, or even you're religious at all. What you're known for is your aesthetics. What do you eat? Where do you go? This is one of the aspects of Barack Obama. He is admired a lot by aspects of the left because he is considered to be one of the people who have a great understanding of modern aesthetics. And so, because he dresses well and he knows where to eat and he takes nice vacations. And this is something they see as a great signal as to what makes him a great human being. And a lot of it just has to do with whether you've got good taste or bad taste. Now, I have something to do. Hold on. Sorry, that was a minor interruption. So anyway, so you have this idea of the art world being part of how a society defines itself in the modern world. If you have a community get together in America, unlike the Middle Ages in France, the community doesn't get together and have a big meeting and decide how they're going to build a cathedral. What do they build? What does a community build now? It builds museums. It tries to bring people in for, like I said, for cultural reasons. These different, particularly, and if you look at the bookstores or the stores where they sell magazines, there's all kinds of magazines on where to eat, where to shop, what's the best place to travel, what do you wear, endless amounts of clothes on aesthetics and style. So that's the one aspect of it in America, and this is what we do. We build, and the other thing we do is we build sports stadiums, which is another monument to the same idea. It's our gladiator society building a monument to itself, which is slightly different, but it's along the same lines. In France, what you have with Charlie Hebdo is the country that exemplified this perhaps more than any other country that has ever existed, in my opinion. What the French have always been advertised for, in a sense you want to use the word advertised or discussed, is that France was always seen as the centerpiece of culture. And this was very problematic because France was a deeply Catholic country. And when you live in a world now that has such a very deep anti-clerical, anti-religious outlook, you would have to argue that perhaps this French culture was also intermixed with just the arts and living and style and that. And if you think about what I'm saying, an example of this was the Russian aristocracy. The Russian aristocracy would actually speak French and model itself in the 17th, 18th centuries on being French. They thought it was of a higher calling and a better situation for themselves as human beings if they were French in a way instead of Russian. Though, I guess in their minds, if you're going to be an aristocrat and own half the country, you don't want to look like one of the peasants that you own. So, and there wasn't anything for them to copy, so they went to France. The French have always had this reputation. You have wines, you have the French cooking, which is many people still consider the greatest in the world. You have people who are supposedly have very high tastes, and they have this wonderful kind of civilized socioeconomic system they live in, where a great deal of it is spent on pleasure. And it's considered to be something that makes you freer, and it removes you again, as I talked about in the last show, from a kind of very limited middle-class way of seeing the world. But what I think is very interesting here is this question. All the artwork I talked about that was in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance was what we would call, again, high art. And there's been a lot of discussion over the last 50 years, and I'm not saying anything new here, I'm relaying it to you, that in the modern world, high art now, the art of like Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, the composers, people like this, great painters, you know, who paint, you know, like Michelangelo, that the high art, the art of the educated classes, the art of people who really are trained and understand things, that this is no longer seen as a representation of the culture itself. That in the modern world, popular culture is seen as the actual culture that represents the society. And this is a very deeply disturbing idea for a lot of people. Because if you think about the way in which popular culture is created, it means that in theory, if somebody sold more records or CDs than another artist, for example, that would make them the representative of society. And there are people in this world, I know this is going to come as a shock, who don't want to think of Madonna, the artist, as the cultural representative of the United States. You know, it's just not something that they would really like to do. But if you consider popular culture to be the representative of the culture we live in, and that it is more representative than anything else, then this is what you end up with, is this question, is who is it that represents a society? Artists, traditionally, going back to the 19th century, very often knew that if they were going to be great and they were going to be part of the high culture, that there was a very good chance at some point in time that the society that they worked in and lived in and produced their art in would not accept them. This is a very common story in the 19th century. And in fact, if you read aesthetics from the 1950s in America for people like Jack Kerouac and the Beats and that, there are people who have said that if those men were ever accepted into society by the whole culture itself and were brought in and adopted by the culture, it meant that what they had done had become a failure because it was never supposed to be accepted. It was always supposed to be on the outside of the mainstream of American society. Now, what has all this got to do with Charlie Hebdo? I think it has a lot to do with it. What Charlie Hebdo, it seems to me, brought to the forefront is the idea that that art can be used as a representative of what is considered to be the very best of society. That it has a higher place in society now than religion does. And if one wants to be ultimately cynical about this, if those men who were killed in this attack had been priests in a monastery, would France have had 4 million people come out and march? Now, they may have felt bad about it. They may have said, oh, gee, it's terrible. But I don't know if they would have. And I think what this tells you is that the people of France, who consider themselves amongst the most modern people in the world in every sense, you know, they got rid of their monarchs. They're a liberal democracy. They think of themselves as believing in equality and all this kind of stuff that we all hear about. They felt that when an artist was killed, that this was directly related to their own lives in a way that I would argue with you that if you had killed a priest, it would not have been related to their own lives. If they had murdered 12 priests, there's the chance that a lot of the Frenchmen would have said, well, you know, I don't go to church anymore. And I may have grown up with it, but I don't like it or whatever. But if you attack an art, because artists, it's a big thing, because everybody now in the world, if you look around you, particularly in America, is attached to art in some way. And it's very deep, and it starts in adolescence. I this thesis I'm giving you today is that I think the American society in particular, and it's the one I know, and I think France is a great example of it, is more deeply attached to its aesthetic and those people of popular culture that it admires and wants than it is to anything to do with religion. If you look at the way the average, and I do this because, you know, it happens, you're behind a school bus or something. If you've ever gone out in front of you sat in a school and waited for one of your kids to come out and get in the car, every parent's picked their kid up at some point in his life or her life in front of the school. Look at the kids when they come out of the school. And you can take one look at them, and you can tell that the majority of their time is not spent worrying about Jesus Christ. They're worried about what clothes they have on. They very often have a set of headsets on, and they're listening to some kind of music. They have a phone, and they're texting somebody about what the next movie is or where they're going to go. Where do they want to eat? If you hear people talk as adults now in this society, they don't talk about religion. If you actually ask a person in this society a religious question at a cocktail party, they get very offended because, well, we can't talk about that. But they'll spend the entire day talking about which restaurant in the richest section of town serves the best salmon, or what the best movie is, or when the next iPod's coming out, or how short are the skirts going to be, or how long are the skirts going to be, or are there going to be any skirts at all? And this is the conversation that is the centerpiece of people's lives. And I think the ramifications of living in an entire civilization now that bases its entire outlook on aesthetics is really huge. Because this is going to sound really odd, but when you have the French government decide to bomb ISIS, are they bombing ISIS because ISIS is a Muslim terrorist organization, or can you actually make a very perverted argument that they're bombing these people because they don't have the same aesthetics, that the Muslims don't believe in the really serious fundamental Muslims don't take pictures? It's one reason why we can't get a picture of I think his name is Muhammad. I can't think of his name. The man that founded the Taliban. He's never had a picture taken because he doesn't believe in having pictures taken. It's a graven image. That they don't do the aesthetic things we do. They don't spend their lives worrying about what the best salmon dinner is in their town, or the steakhouse, or where the best movie is. That they live in a world of utterly separate concerns. And what ties into this idea is that it is religion that entraps people, and it is aesthetics that frees people. And I'm going to say that over again. In the modern world, the only freedom you can achieve is through aesthetics. If you see a woman that lives in a religious community in America, very often in severe religious communities, those women wear a particular kind of dress and kind of hairstyle, and kind of many of them have to wear hats. You know, in the Muslim world, it's the burqa. Now, the first thing that happens when a person is freed from that religious belief in the modern world is they will immediately change how they dress. They'll immediately change what they eat. They'll change, because if you think about it, in an odd way, religion does have control over aesthetics. If you are in a very austere Protestant sect in America, for example, and Catholics have some of this too, but I'm familiar with the Protestant side, they will attempt to control your aesthetics. They tell you, I was in a church yesterday, and there was a little poster on the wall designed for teenage children, and it said, it was a poster about you should dress modestly. It's about how to dress. And many religions tell you what to eat, and they tell you how to marry and your sex lives, and they tell you in very many ways what's good or bad to do artistically in that way. It's a controlling factor, perhaps, but in the Western world, again, We think aesthetics is the only way to be free, and that religion is what inhibits us and prevents us from being free. And so in a very astounding way, the argument between aesthetics and religion is an argument over freedom and the definition of being free. I've mentioned this, I'm sure, but it's very much worth repeating. I heard a homily once by a priest that I admired, and he said that the concept of freedom in religion is an entirely different concept of freedom than it is in the secular world. Religion does not believe in absolute freedom. It doesn't think it exists. It doesn't believe that a human being has a right to do whatever he or she wants to do. And I remember when I haven't heard him so much anymore, but one time I was driving around somewhere and I was listening to a Michael Savage show, the conservative commentator on the radio, and he had a caller call him up and tell him that the caller said that he believed in absolute freedom, that he had the right as a human being to do whatever he wanted. And Savage kind of laughed at him and said, "That's not how the world works. You can't shoot your neighbor because you're free. I mean, this isn't how we work." And what the priest said is, in religion, freedom means that you have the right to do what is good. You have the freedom to do good. It's a free will question. Freedom is about your ability to do something. It's not about the right to just to do whatever you want. And what that means is that in a religious context, we're not trapped into being evil or terrible. We still have a part of us that is capable of doing good. And that is what freedom is for. It gives us the ability to do the good. And I would argue that in a popular cultural way, that is not at all what freedom and aesthetics means. These guys who ran the Charlie Hebdo magazine said some really, really nasty things about the Muslim faith. And again, use freedom of speech, all that, fine. But in a religious freedom context, that would not have permitted them to do it, because in the religious context, you would have had to ask the question, okay, you're free to do this if you want, but is this the good? Are you doing this as a part of the good? And, of course, now this is what the current Pope has brought up. The current Pope is, you know, he said that more or less, and you kind of have to, the way he speaks sometimes, you really got to read a lot and kind of read between the lines. But my interpretation of what he said was, okay, these guys were allowed to do this, but it was the wrong thing to do. You can argue that Charlie Hebdo may have been free in a liberal secular society to do this. And we don't want to go back to the old system through the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance all the way up to the modern world of communists, of running around kidnapping artists and torturing them because we don't believe in what they're saying. But what the Pope said was, it was not for the good. It shouldn't, even though they could do it, it shouldn't they have done it. But in aesthetics, people who practice radical aesthetics think that there's nothing that they can't do because the world of free aesthetics has given them permission. The most obvious example of this in America was the very famous cross and a bucket of urine. Does aesthetics give you permission to put a cross in a bucket of urine? If it does, then people will eventually question whether or not the entire idea of how aesthetics operates is losing its moral compass and is losing its way in the modern world. But at this point in time, we are so connected to aesthetics and we are so obsessed with what it does for us on an everyday level, the endless entertainment and the endless need for it. The endless, if you look, lifestyle coaches and all these people who tell you how to live the lifestyle, that it's not going to change anytime soon, and I don't think it's going to be questioned by the next generation. And so it's fascinating to me how this came out. I still don't know and I have thought about this now for quite some time. If those men who went in and killed the men at the magazine had gone into a church, as I said before, or a monastery and killed 12 priests, I just don't know if there would have been 3 million people protesting or showing any solidarity with the church. And I think this really needs to be thought about in a very serious way. Thank you very much. My time is up again, and have a great holiday.